Thanks for purchasing this graphic audio adventure, another high-impact movie in your mind, and more. The last CD of this audiobook is an enhanced CD, which means you can put it into your computer, and it will connect you, just like that, to the amazing world of graphic audio at our website, www.graphicaudio.net. That's right, just put the last disc of this volume into your computer, follow the on-screen instructions, and you'll be there in seconds, just like that. Also on your enhanced CD is the latest catalog of all our titles. Every one produced in unforgettable, high-impact graphic audio. It's all there waiting for you. Graphic audio, a movie in your mind, and a whole lot more.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands, narrated by Richard Rowan, with performances by Terrence Acil Ford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King Williams, Nanette Stavard, David Coyne, Sonny Lasky, Michael Glenn, Karen Carbone, Casey Jones, Kate Torrey, Tim Carlin, James Konacek, and Mort Shelby. Deathlands number 21, Twilight Children.
The cold fingers of fog were drifting away, out of Ryan Cotter's brain. The one constant thing that someone could safely say about making a matter transfer jump was that there was no constant thing about making a jump. Sometimes there were dreams during the period of unconscious blackness, gibbering nightmares more often than sweet dreams. Sometimes there was no sensation of time passing at all. The mind closed down and then opened up again, like a parched flower during a spring rain, with no awareness that anything at all had happened. Except the one certainty that the complex machine, dating back nearly 100 years, to the last days before the nuclear holocaust devastated the Earth, would definitely have taken you somewhere different. It could be 100 miles away, or it could be 10,000 miles to another of the so-called gateways that had been built and buried in one of the chain of triple-secure military complexes known as redoubts. The trouble with jumping was that you had no control over the destination. All the instructions had vanished during the nuking and the long winters that followed, and every living person who might once have known was long, long dead. Most Matrans jumps left you feeling like someone had sliced the top of your skull off, scrambled the soft tissues inside, then jammed the lid back on. It also churned up your guts like you'd been strapped under a war wag, going flat out across 40 miles of bad road. As Ryan lurched back toward waking, he was aware that this particular jump hadn't been too bad.
Some you lose, and some you draw.
When he'd locked the sector on the chamber in the redoubt in Kansas, triggering the mechanism, everyone there had been holding hands, and the armor glass walls had been a virulent shade of cherry red. Now, his hands were free. Several jumps ago, something had gone horrifically wrong, and Ryan and his 6 companions had all ended in different destinations, only getting back together by a mix of judgment and luck. Ryan opened his good eye. The walls in this gateway were a dull, indeterminate shade of gray, closer to black than white. The metallic discs dotted across the floor and the ceiling had resumed their usual color, and the white mist that often flooded the chamber during a jump had vanished. Everyone was there. Christy Roth, next to him, lay sprawled against a wall, her brilliantly red, sentient hair packed tight across her shoulders, crowding onto her nape as though it were trying to protect her. His 11-year-old son Dean was halfway across Christy's lap, his eyes squeezed shut. 19-year-old Michael Brother was doubled over, his knees drawn up in the fetal position, a tiny thread of scarlet blood at the corner of his mouth, as though he might have nipped his tongue during the jump. J.B. Dix, Ryan's oldest friend and armorer to the group, was also beginning to stir. His normally sallow face was even paler than usual. Without his glasses, his eyes looked oddly naked and unprotected. His scattergun was at his side, his Uzi clutched to his chest. Mildred Wyatt, the black doctor, was breathing very heavily, her mouth sagging and open, her left hand gripping JB's right. The last of the seven friends was Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner, who was stretched out next to Ryan, flat on his back, his hands folded across his stomach, holding the gold-plated Jeb Stuart Lamont blaster. Normally it was Doc who had the biggest problem in using the Matran system. Even at the best of times, his brain was a touch unreliable, and the pressures of jumping sometimes pushed him a few inches closer to the edge. On occasion, it had even pushed him completely into the abyss of insanity. Ryan looked at Doc's wrinkled face, the silvery stubble showing through the leathery skin. It wasn't that surprising that Doc often found life in the last part of the 21st century hard to bear. He'd been born in South Stratford, Vermont, on February 14th in the year of our Lord, 1868, and was married to Emily Chandler 23 years later on June 17th. Had two children, Rachel, born in the second year of their marriage, and a little Joyen, born to the happy parents 2 years later. In November of 1896, Doc had been in Omaha, Nebraska. In a nanosecond, he was transported to a laboratory in a discreet and heavily guarded building somewhere in Virginia, 102 years later. It was a time of extreme fragility and suspicion in international relations, and the United States of America had poured limitless amounts of dollars into the ultra-secret Totality Project, which explored arcane and esoteric possibilities for future warfare. One of its subdivisions was over Project Whisper, which in its turn had spawned numerous other research missions. One, Cerberus, involved the transfer of matter from one location to another, which became known as jumping. Another research mission was called Operation Kronos and focused on time trawling. Kronos had some spectacular and hideously disgusting failures. Not many of their targets ever arrived in the year 2000, either physically or mentally whole. Some simply disappeared. But Doc had arrived, mentally scarred, but he arrived and lived. However, they had picked a bad subject. Doc wouldn't sit quiet under their battery of tests and interrogation, insisting on trying by every means necessary to try to rejoin his wife and family. In the end, the faceless military scientists got rid of him. They sent him forward in time to the heart of Deathlands, where he came close to death before being rescued by Ryan Cotter. Michael Brother was also one of the tiny number of successfully trawled victims of Kronos, helped into the dubious future by Ryan and the others. In the late 1900s, he'd been taken as a baby into a closed monastic order near Visalia in the Sierras. He'd spent all of his life as an oblate within the serene community of Nilvanity, then was sucked away by Kronos into the late part of the next century. Mildred was also from the past, but time trawling wasn't responsible for her being stuck in Deathlands. Born in 1964, Mildred had become one of the country's leading experts on cryogenics and cryosurgery, the science of medical freezing. Ironically, at the age of 36, she'd gone into hospital for routine minor surgery, which had gone wrong. She'd been frozen, deeply unconscious, not long before the missiles darkened the skies of the world, and civilization came to a grinding halt. Not with a whimper, but with a mega bang. During the exploration of one of the concealed redoubts, Ryan and his friends had come across Mildred, sealed away, her life support system powered by a long-running and reliable nuke generator, and they had brought her back to the land of the living.
Feel sick, Dad.
Hang on, Dean. Just try to sit up and keep your head still. It'll pass.
JB was also coming around, His first movement was to fumble his fingers over the stock of the Uzi. Then he reached down for the Smith & Wesson M4000 shotgun on the floor.
Not too bad as jumps go. You okay, Ryan?
Yeah, wasn't a bad one.
I love her. Once again, we made it with nothing worse than a nauseous headache.
Ryan stood, reaching a hand down to help Christy to her feet. Dean and JB were also up, stretching, easing the kinks out of their spines. Michael was coming around, his eyes blinking fast, his head shaking from side to side.
Hey. I don't feel too bad. We did jump, didn't we? Oh yeah, the walls were red last time, weren't they?
Can't feel much. No, air tastes like it generally does. Flat and... There's kind of a bitter chemical smell to it, though. At least it's not corpses like the last place.
Bless me.
Mildred shook her head.
You all right?
Think so. Yes, not too bad. The walls were that screaming red last time, weren't they? I'm not sure this gray is much of an improvement.
Now everyone was up but Doc, who slept on, oblivious to the six friends gathered around him. Mildred put her index finger against his throat, checking his pulse.
Slow, but not that slow.
JB was examining the walls of the gateway chamber.
You notice this, Ryan?
What?
Sort of careless built.
Ryan looked more closely and saw what JB meant. The sheets of armaglass didn't quite match up, and some kind of sealant had been pushed into the gaps. One of the walls was cracked, and two of the sealing discs were actually hanging loose.
Yeah. That's the first time I've ever noticed anything like that.
Last year's loving bitter still remains.
Doc's on his way back out of the darkness.
There is no memory of her here.
Doc's eyes blinked open, staring sightlessly at the ceiling, gradually returning to focus on the walls and the six faces looking down at him.
Upon my soul, my dear friends, I wondered when we seven would meet again. And here we are. But not upon a blasted heath. A bastard reef. Last teeth.
He struggled to sit up, helped by Mildred and JB.
Have we successfully completed our jump? I see we have, from the change in hue. But I confess that I feel less sickly than is usual at such moments. Perhaps I'm finally building a tolerance to such events.
We all feel better than we normally do after a jump. If we're all okay to go, we can take a look at where we finished up.
He didn't need to tell them all to draw their blasters. Coming out of the gateway was one of the potentially dangerous scenarios in the Deathlands. But this time was oddly different. Normally, there was a small anteroom immediately off the actual Matrans chamber. The size varied a little from redoubt to redoubt, but they were usually somewhere around 10 feet square, plainly decorated, mostly unfurnished. This time it was simply a cave, roughly hewn from bare stones, a dull gray rock lined with narrow seams of shimmering green quartz. The ceiling was less than 8 feet high, and the walls were only about 6 feet apart. Other than a patina of very fine dusty sand, it was empty. Michael Brother ran his finger down the stone.
It's still got the marks of the chisel. Looks like it was done only yesterday.
Must have been one of the last redoubts to be built before Skydark.
Nobody had ever known how many of the massive military fortresses had been constructed during the last years of international tension before Nuke Day came and went. When Ryan had ridden with a trader, they'd been lucky enough to come across several. One in the apse had contained several mothballed war wags on which the trader had based his whole operation. Another, 150 miles north of the ruins of Boston, had contained enough stored tanks of high-octane gas to keep them in jack for years. All that was known was that the chain of redoubts had been a part of the totality concept, and that they'd been constructed under conditions of the utmost secrecy. Despite the protests of the conservationists, the government had compulsorily taken over huge sectors of the country, including thousands of square miles of some of the most favored, most beautiful, and most isolated national parks. The irony was that the eventual war was so sudden and apocalyptic that the redoubts proved to have absolutely zero military significance, and most showed signs of having been rapidly evacuated in the last few weeks of what remained of civilization and order. By traveling from gateway to gateway, Ryan and his companions had located many more hidden redoubts in varying stages of preservation or destruction. But they'd certainly never come across one that looked like it was still being built. Until now.
Look here, Dad!
Dean had gone ahead, through the crudely carved doorway, into what would normally be the control room for the entire Matrans operation. There would be rows of consoles and banks of comp desks with dancing gauges and flickering dials and lights. All were powered by a hidden nuke gen, pulsing away in the deeps of the fortress. Christy followed the boy through, pausing and looking around her in disbelief.
There's something seriously wrong here, lover.
It's just a hut, Dad.
The walls and ceiling of the building were bare rock, with the same thread of emerald quartz running through it. But it was barely a quarter the size of the normal control room. There were comp consoles, but only 20 or so, mounted on makeshift tables, some with broken legs propped on red bricks.
The air. It's not like it usually is either.
Ryan breathed in, half closing his eye. Mildred was right. It didn't have that dusty flatness that recirculated air normally had. This was bitter and sharp, like a vaporized acid rainstorm. There were loops of multicolored cable draped all over the place, with junction boxes and ends of sprayed bare metal. It was amazing that the gateway was still functioning after the best part of a century, though it crossed Ryan's mind to wonder whether this Matrans unit might actually have been rebuilt within the past few years. If so, it was a staggering thought, and opened all kinds of unsuspected possibilities. JB was walking slowly around, reaching up to touch the rock overhead, examining his fingers.
It's dry. This couldn't have run if it had been damp.
These portals to the outer world are unlike any that I've ever seen. They resemble nothing more than an ordinary door on a frontier outhouse.
Doc was exaggerating a little, but only a little. The familiar vanadium steel sectors, weighing hundreds of tons and operated by a complex system of gears and counterweights, weren't there. There was a single wide door with an ordinary handle, like you might put on a garden shed. It was made from wooden planks, some of them warped and crooked, with a length of 1x4 nailed across to hold the thing together. Once upon a time it had been white, but the paint had dried and flaked, like buildings in a desert ghost town. The strip lights overhead were harsh, and at least a quarter of them had malfunctioned. Ryan shook his head.
I don't get it. This isn't like a Matrans unit. It's like some handyman got a hold of bits and pieces that fell off the back of a wag, and he just put them all together and found he'd built a gateway. But the damn thing worked. It got us here all right.
Maybe we should leave right now. Could be safer.
JB tapped on the door with the butt of his Uzi.
One-armed baby could knock this down.
Why not open it? At least take a look outside, huh, Dad?
I guess.
The door wasn't even locked. The boy simply turned the handle and pushed, and it opened, revealing a dark, constricting passage.
Wait, don't go rushing into that like a double stoop, Dean. There could be anything out there.
A most maleficent odor, like touching your tongue to tarnished brass.
Nice one, Doc. I know what you mean. It isn't that deathly medical smell from the other redoubt in Kansas, but it isn't normal.
Ryan went to the door, pushing past Dean. The place was so small and cramped that there hardly seemed to be enough room for the seven of them. Once again, the contrast with other complexes they'd visited was stark. Instead of the wide corridors, with antiseptically clean concrete walls and high curved ceilings, this was more like the mouth of a tunnel built by gnomes. There were no lights, and not a sign of the usual observation vid cameras. The passage was around 10 feet at its widest, so low that Ryan felt he had to stoop, oddly aware of the enormous weight of rock and earth hanging over him. As his eye became accustomed to the gloom outside the control area, Ryan realized that there was a very faint glow visible away to his right.
I think this place is totally open. Doesn't look like artificial light. The smell of the air is stronger.
Doc's description hung in his mind. The taste was definitely metallic in origin. One by one they followed Ryan, all of them stooping, though the ceiling was just high enough for Doc, tallest at 6'3", to stand straight without bumping his head. They didn't have far to go. The light ahead grew steadily brighter, showing that the whole place had been hacked out of living rocks, also showing that the gateway seemed to be on its own, without the usual surrounding redoubt. Ryan held up his hand as the rough-floored passage curved sharply to the right, almost in a dogleg.
Hold it just a minute. Christy?
Yeah?
You feel anything?
No.
Nothing? Must be some sort of life around.
Christy pressed the tips of her fingers to her forehead. While she concentrated hard, Ryan became aware that the fiery sentient hair was curled tight around her head and neck, often a sign of potential danger. Christy bit her lip.
No. Can't pick up anything at all. Not close by, anyway.
Well, best go see.
The tunnel simply ended in a roughly circular opening, with daylight beyond. One of the oddities about jumping was that it screwed up time in a way that Ryan had never been able to work out. Sometimes you might jump in the middle of the night, and you'd find that you'd arrived at the next redoubt in the middle of the afternoon. Now his wristchron said that it was 11 minutes after 9 in the morning.
Think we might be near the sea. Walls are wet and the air seems damp.
Ryan was first out of the passage, finding himself on a ledge of sculpted rock, barely 10 feet wide. To his left, there was a steep wall of granite, rising into a thick mist. To the right, the ledge became a trail, winding out of sight. There were no doors, and no sign of anything else that might have been a part of a bigger complex.
I don't get it. Anyone could have just walked in and smashed up the gateway, nothing to stop them.
Maybe it's so completely isolated that there isn't anyone here, not even a passing mutie. Fire blast!
Christy jumped.
What?
Maybe this is a triple bad hotspot.
Ryan checked the tiny rad counter stitched into the sleeve of his coat. But it showed only a placid, safe green. JB also checked his, finding the same reading.
No hotspot.
Where are we? Looks like the inside of a Sticky's ass.
Everyone fell silent, looking around them. There seemed to be a mist, both above and below them, cutting off visibility. The air was cool and moist, the cliffs jagged and irregular, rising all around them. The more Ryan stared, the stranger it all looked. He couldn't find any trace of life anywhere, not even smears of moss or lichen on the boulders. He scuffed his boots in the dirt, noticing that even the most ubiquitous plant in the Deathlands was absent. The tiny multi-petaled daisies, with their delicate yellow and white coloring, were found from Alaska to the Gulf. But not here.
Yeah, JB, where are we?
The armorer fumbled in his pockets and pulled out the microsextant, squinting around the sky.
No sun. Still, I'll find where the light's brightest.
After a couple of minutes, he shook his head.
I can't get a reading at all. Might be something wrong with this.
He put the miniature instrument back in his coat.
I'll try the compass and see if... Dark night!
They all gathered around JB, seeing that the needle on the magnetic compass was swinging wildly from north to south, then revolving in a blur of speed, not settling for a moment at any particular point.
Anomalies. They are known to exist in certain places where the underlying strata contain high proportions of lodestone. Some kind of considerable electromagnetic disturbance.
Michael had walked to the edge and was peering cautiously over the brink.
Can't make out anything. Though, no. I thought I saw something flying through the fog way below, but it vanished. Something real big.
Looks to me like the Valley of the Shadow of Death, doesn't it? The land that time forgot. Ultima Thule, end of all things.
There was a puddle of water by Ryan's boots, and he stooped and dipped a finger in it, noticing that there was an oily rainbow sheen on it. He touched his finger to his lips.
Bitter. Tastes like bad water, down in the heart of Dry Valley.
Do you think there could have been some kind of chemical pollution here? Not radiation. There was a lot of talk before I got frozen. Talk that the Ruskies had all sorts of nerve and chemical agents. Nobody knew if it was true. There had been some used in the Middle East in the 80s and 90s. This just looks like some ghastly leakage or spillage of some industrial poison.
Dean slapped at something.
Ow! Stung me on the cheek! Look, I got the fucker!
Nobody corrected Dean's language, all of them looking at the bizarre insect that he held, trembling in the palm of his hand. It was an inch and a half long, its narrow body a dull gold color. There were 4 sets of filmy gray wings, and its head had 6 separate eyes, like tiny orbs of polished copper. At the end of its tapering tail, there was a sting. grossly out of proportion to its overall length. JB examined it carefully.
Like a scorpion, hooked and barbed.
Christy peered at the boy's face, where a nasty lump was already swelling.
Keep an eye on that, Dean.
Don't think it had much chance to squirt its poison in before I got it. Oh, it hurts like a bastard, though.
Dean tipped it off his hand onto the shale at his feet and crushed it under his heel. Doc looked around at the misty wasteland.
The whole atmosphere is redolent of despair. For once, I would like my voice heard on behalf of making a jump again immediately. I have not been an eager apostle for this, but...
Sorry, Doc, but there's something triple weird here. That gateway looked like it had been thrown together. No redoubt. Open to anyone passing through. Now we can't find any way of even knowing where we are. So I figure we should explore a little.
I do see the gist of your thinking, my dear fellow. No doubt the rest of our little party agrees with you. Well, nobody disagrees with you. Come then, let us leave this peak in Darien and venture into this slough of despond.
Ryan felt more uneasy than he had for a very long time. The short hairs at his nape were prickling. But, apart from the undoubted dreariness of the region, there didn't seem any immediate danger.
Let's go look.
This air's so rotten it makes you feel tired.
Christy was second in their skirmish line, with Dean following close behind her.
Seems like a part of the planet that Gaia must have overlooked.
As usual, the rest of the group was strung out, with JB bringing up the rear, the 20-round 9mm Uzi held loosely in his hands. By the time they descended about 150 feet, they found themselves in one of the swirling banks of fog. It was puzzling the way the banks of cloud kept moving around them, as there wasn't a breath of wind. The stones were soft and crumpled beneath their feet, making progress unsteady and dangerous. At no point was the man-made track wider than a dozen feet, and there was no way of guessing the deeps that lay to their left. Once they were within the acrid mist, visibility was down to 15 or 20 feet. Ryan knew from previous experience that muties love to attack from the heart of fog or darkness.
Close up, everyone, and stay on triple red alert.
There was still little or no sign of life around. But there were little tufts of sickly yellowish sedge growing in some of the cracks between the moldering stones. The canyons were so deeply blighted that Ryan twice checked his rad counter, tapping it with his forefinger in case it was malfunctioning. But it remained stubbornly in the safe green level, showing no inclination to move toward yellow or orange, which meant there was no residual danger from the nuking.
Nearest thing to a hot spot I ever saw.
The trail zigzagged sharply, the surface furrowed by rains and broken up by years of frosts. Ryan doubted that any sizable wag could ever have gotten up it. Now it would be totally impassable except on foot. At the sound, all of them ducked, raising their blasters. Ryan stared up into the mist, aware only of something vast flying close by them, bringing with it the stench of rotted meat. The cloud was too thick to make out details, but Ryan had a momentary flash of a long, leathery neck and an elongated reptilian head with several sets of protruding yellow teeth. It seemed to have a wingspan in excess of 30 feet, but it could have been distorted by the fog. Christy stood upright again and faced the direction the creature had gone.
What was that? Anyone able to see it properly?
Looked kind of like a gator.
Dean pointed his Browning vaguely into the slate sky. Mildred was perspiring, despite the dank chill in the air.
A flying alligator? I've seen most things, but...
I confess that I caught only the merest glimpse of the creature, but it bore a more than passing resemblance to what the boy said.
There were more pools of the oily water, lying in hollows and crevices, all of it so alkaline and bitter that it was hopelessly undrinkable. At one of the labyrinthine turnings of the track, there was the rotted stump of a vast tree, a good 5 yards in diameter. Since it was one of the first signs of anything approaching normal life, Michael stopped to look at it. He recoiled in disgust.
Ugh! It's a mass of some sort of maggots, but they're as big as your thumb and like white jelly!
Ryan was having second and third thoughts about the wisdom of carrying on with the wreck.
My cron stopped.
That brought Ryan to a halt. He checked his own cron, finding that the numbers had frozen, showing a time only a few minutes after their arrival in the open air.
Must be that electromagnetic thing that Doc mentioned. Screws up direction and time.
If you relied on a real timepiece instead of those tinny and cheapjack digital bits of frippery, then you might care to know that we've been on this shifting, whispering trail for just over 53 minutes.
Doc was holding his silver pocket watch in his right hand, angling it to catch the poor light.
How come his Gron has that kind of pair of needles to tell the time?
They are called hands, dear boy. My pocket watch is a good deal older than I am, which is saying something. It is also a sight more reliable than my body or my brain, and vastly and unarguably to be preferred against those wrist crons, I believe.
Now they could catch the noise of running water, a sullen and deathly sound, less than 100 feet below. The height of the unseen peaks around, glimpsed briefly through the shifting banks of cloud, laid a leaden weight on everyone's heart, and I was none of the usual good-natured banter. The rocks underfoot were treacherous and slippery, taking full concentration to avoid a nasty fall. Ryan began to notice more vegetation, though it was in keeping with the desolate place. Stunted and mutated, it wasn't a plant any of them could identify. The dominant color was gray, dark gray, with veins of sulfurous yellow running through it. Most of the vegetation were bushes, though a stooped tree, crooked and broken, had occasionally found a foothold in among the crevices of the boulders, nourished by the poisonous water. There was also more life, of sorts. They saw no repeat of the monstrous creature floating low over their heads, though the fog occasionally echoed to bizarre cries, yelps, and screams. Ryan spotted some kind of muty thing. It wasn't exactly an insect or a lizard or an animal, but it was a vile mix of all three. Though it had 6 stumpy clawed legs, they propelled it in a peculiar scuttling sideways movement. Its head, with a fringe of spiky hairs, was narrow and fierce. It hissed at the 7 intruders into its domain. From snout to the quivering tip of its barbed tail, it was less than 9 inches, the skin a set of overlapping mottled scales. Its eyes were an opaque crimson, standing out from the skull on stalks that enabled it to glare in every direction at once.
I'll kill it!
Dean leveled his heavy blaster, but his father knocked his arm down.
Next time you do something as triple stoop as that, son, I'll put you on your back in the dirt, you hear me?
Sure, sure! Keep the rad green, Dad, no harm!
Dean backed quickly away. Ryan felt a pulse throbbing in the empty socket of his left eye, and he swallowed hard to control the red mist.
No harm. That little muty bastard wasn't doing us any harm. This is a shit dangerous and fucking creepy place, Dean. I never saw anywhere like this. None of us did. Krons don't run, the compass doesn't work, the sun doesn't fucking shine. We don't know what's out there, do we?
Sorry, Dad.
Yeah. And I'm sorry I went off at you like a rogue grin launcher, Dean. But you pulled the trigger on that Browning, and you could alert any living bastard within 5 miles that there's outlanders in their territory.
I see that now. Sorry.
Never apologize, son. It's a sign of weakness.
Mildred grinned at Ryan.
Not the best John Wayne impersonation, but probably the best one in Deathlands.
At last, the track began to level out. It was lined with a kind of sagebrush and decorated with gray-white berries that gave off a bitter dust if anyone brushed against them. They saw several more of the 6-legged muty creatures, but nothing that represented an obvious threat. Christie pointed to their left.
There's the river. Gaia, it looks as inviting as everything else around here. Dismal isn't the word.
They stood in a row, all staring in silence at the slow-flowing water. Above them, the acidic layer of fog shifted in impenetrable coils, making it impossible to see anything more than 100 feet high. The river was 40 to 50 feet wide, with a shelving beach on both sides. The rocks that protruded above the surface were greasy, looking as though they were composed of gray mud. The color of the water was an oily brown, but it was moving so unhurriedly that Ryan blinked, thinking he was a victim of a trick of the admittedly poor light.
That river, I would swear that it was going past us in slow motion, or are my tired old eyes deceiving me?
Michael stepped down over the banks of shingle, perfectly balanced, and knelt at the edge of the river. He reached out slowly and dipped a hand into the water, pulling it hastily out, shaking his fingers and wiping them quickly on his black parka.
It's warm! It stinks! It isn't water!
What is it?
Kind of thicker than water. Consistency of very thin honey or cooking oil.
Before any of them could even open their mouths to shout a warning, something darted from the oily liquid, propelling itself toward the oblivious teenager's throat. There was only a moment for a glimpse, but Ryan had the impression of a large rat with fins and webbed feet, or a furred fish with a body and head like a rodent. Though he was facing away from the footlong mutie, Michael's astounding combat reflexes saved him, but from at best a nasty bite. His right hand punched sideways, hitting the thing in midair, chopping it a few yards along the pebbles. It landed on its back, but wriggled over and propelled itself, not back to the safety of the river, but toward the kneeling man. Mildred had her ZKR 551 drawn and cocked, and she sighted along the barrel of the check target revolver, glancing sideways toward Ryan, waiting for his word to put a 38 round through the malevolent monstrosity.
No!
Michael uncoiled and stood with his legs a little apart, braced and ready for the attack. We could all hear a very strange sound coming from the thing's needled mouth. Michael was wearing his sturdy knee-high hiking boots, and he waited until the mutie was within range of him. He kicked out once, sending the creature spinning along the shingle. He followed it, hesitating only for a second before bringing his heel down on it, crushing the small body into the stones. He turned away with an expression of disgust.
Its skin must be like paper! It just burst open and rotted in front of me! Now there's just, like, a sticky puddle of stinking grunge left!
How's the time, Doc?
The silver watch appeared from the fob pocket of his waistcoat.
Not too far off noon, my dear fellow. I was wondering whether it might be possible to find anything to eat in this godforsaken place. I have never seen a place that was so literally forsaken by the Almighty.
J.B. looked around them.
I'd be double surprised if there was a creature here that we could safely eat, Doc. Think about that ratfish that went for Michael.
What's that?
Christy was shading her eyes, looking farther down the valley to where the strange river made a sweeping curve from the left. There was a cluster of buildings, looking to be wood-framed, like some kind of frontierville. It was one of the last things that Ryan had expected to see in this hostile wilderness of acid water and fog and ghastly nuke muties.
Might be some folks there. Could even be food, Doc.